Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. African Americans are 40% more likely to have high blood pressure and twice as likely to be diagnosed with diabetes than non-Hispanic whites. The infant mortality rate for black babies is double the rate of white babies. The health disparities for African Americans is staggering, but it's just one category of crucial issues facing people of color. In 2006, public media talk show host Tavis Smiley, with a team of contributors, laid down a national plan of action to address the 10 most crucial issues facing African Americans. In a new book, Smiley looks back at what's been accomplished to better the lives of black people in the United States. The book is entitled The Covenant with Black America, 10 Years Later. Tavis Smiley joins us now. Welcome to the show, Tavis.
And good to be on. Thanks for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
What brought this together in the first place in 2006?
So 2006, the book comes out in part because Black America had endured at that point almost 8 years of the Bush presidency, number one. Number two, you recall that in 2005, Hurricane Katrina hit and Kanye West famously said that George Bush doesn't care about black people, whether one comes down on whatever side of that issue you come down on. At the end of the day, black people lost their lives in Katrina, and all the indicators are pointing in the wrong direction for black America. So a number of African-American scholars and influencers and thought leaders, opinion makers came together to put this, to lay out a national plan of action for what African-Americans needed to do to turn the tide against all that ails us. And here we are now, 10 years later, and so one obviously asked the question, what has happened in the last decade since this book came out? Went to number one on the New York Times bestseller list, stayed there for many weeks. Mm-hmm. There were two presidential debates based on this book in 2007. The Democrats, for the first time ever, debated for 90 minutes nothing but black issues at Howard University live on PBS in prime time. The Republicans debated the contents of this book at Morgan State University in Baltimore in prime time on PBS. And so the book had a huge impact when it came out 10 years ago, but the question again now, Ann, is what's happened over the last 10 years?
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You probably recognize the voice. It's Tavis Smiley, host of The Tavis Smiley Show on PBS. He's also the editor and compiler of a new edition of The Covenant with Black America, 10 years later. If you have a question or comment for Tavis Smiley, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And probably, you said that when you compiled and edited The Covenant with Black America 10 years ago, you had no idea that things would be worse.
Yeah. What a difference a decade makes, and I had no idea that this would be the narrative. This book came out in 2006, of course. We had no idea we'd be looking at an African-American president. But the sad reality is, and it pains me deeply to even have to acknowledge this, but this is where the data takes us. Black America has lost ground in every major economic category over the last 10 years. Not one, two, or three, but in all of the major economic indicator categories, black folk have lost ground over the last 10 years. It's a sad story. Time is not on our side. The book came out before Obama, so it's not just an indictment of the president. And this book, 10 years later, is not so much an indictment of him, although things have worsened on his watch. But ultimately, it's about black America and what we're going to do to make sure that this community gets a chance to flower and flourish before time runs out.
Historically, black America suffers more when during economic downturns. So that's part of the story.
It is. When white America gets a cold, as has been famously said, when white folk get a cold, black folk get pneumonia. So there's no doubt about the fact that the things have been more difficult for these Africans. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I think there are a few other issues, though, Ann, why these numbers have been so damning over the last 10 years. In part, number one, we continue to render the suffering of too many fellow citizens invisible. Poverty is threatening our democracy. Poverty is now a matter of national security. And, of course, when you combine poverty and race, that's a combustible force. So that, one, we continue to ignore what the data is telling us. Number two, black folk have been too deferential to this president. That is to say, they've gotten caught up in the symbolism, but have not really pressed on the substance. And I get that on a certain level. He's the first black president. You don't want to pile on. The Republicans are obstructing. He's getting death threats every day. But you can't be so deferential that you do it to your own detriment. And then, finally, there's been too much indifference too much indifference on the part of other fellow citizens, and certainly those Republicans who tried to block everything he's done. So the president could have done more. He could have been more bold, but he certainly has had a serious headwind as well.
You made a reference to this just a few minutes ago, and also in your introduction to the new edition, you said that at this critical juncture with so little time to waste in order to save the soul of Black America, why is this a critical juncture, and what do you mean by so little time to waste? You said we're running out of time.
Yeah, I think that we're getting to a point now where if something doesn't happen quickly, and I'm not a pessimist, I'm a prisoner of hope. I'm not an optimist either. But I'm a prisoner of hope. But the clock is running out. And we're falling so far behind, I wonder whether or not we'll ever be able to catch up. For example, we have now arrived at a place in Black history where, for the first time, and Black children born today are not going to do as well as their parents have done, which means that our Black ancestors are turning over in their grave at the thought that Black kids born today are not going to do as well as their parents, which clearly means that the eyes of the future are looking back at us and praying for us to get this right. Black children yet unborn will never have a chance to live their life of full meaning and full promise if we can't get this figured out now. But the numbers are getting so bad that you start to wonder whether or not this is intractable and whether or not we can ever turn it around.
It's also improbable that when you think about all of the technology that's been unveiled and put to work over the last 10 years, you could look 10 years. And what it's also done, according to lots of people, is create a larger gap. It's created more disparity.
Well, it has, in fact, created more disparity. But these disparities existed prior to Obama getting into office. Mm-hmm. I regret the fact, and I hate the fact, quite frankly, that more hasn't been done to deal with these disparities. And there are all kinds of disparities. The disparities, of course, as you referenced, economically. Mm-hmm. Black people are still the last hired and the first fired. We're still unemployed. We're still underemployed. Too many folk have just given up looking for work. So those economic disparities certainly exist, but there are also health disparities. But whatever is going to come of Obamacare once these provisions really start to kick in, particularly that pre-existing conditions provision, I think the health of Black people will be benefited in the long run by the Obamacare policy. But the Obamacare policy does nothing about health disparities, and so Black women still die disproportionately from preventable diseases. Mm-hmm. And so these disparities are real, and it's one thing just to try to get in the game, to try to catch up. But even if you catch up, you still have these disparities that you have to deal with.
When the book was compiled, the collection of essays was compiled 10 years ago, who were you speaking to? Because it was, as you mentioned, it was on the New York Times bestseller list for a long time. It wasn't just, you weren't just speaking to African Americans.
I'm glad you asked that. These issues clearly represent a problem for Black America. It's Black America's problem, but it's white America's burden. These issues are fast becoming an American catastrophe that's about to blow up in our faces if we don't start to do something about them. I believe that when you make Black America better, you make all of America better. In so many ways, as goes Black America, so goes the nation. Quick example. So Black folk are the ones who've been raising the issue over the last few years about police misconduct. It's these Black boys and Black men who are being shot and killed by cops in Ohio and elsewhere, Tamir Rice. Mm-hmm. It's Black boys and Black men who've been shot and killed by cops. Too many cops getting away with this. But here's the problem. Something happens to a society. You start moving closer and closer to anarchy when the citizens writ large can't feel like they can trust law enforcement. And that's what's starting to happen. It's not just Black folk now who are starting to look strangely at these cops who are doing some awfully weird things and getting caught on tape. But it's not just cops. Look at Chicago and Rahm Emanuel. This is the guy that Obama campaigned for two times, mm-hmm, to get him elected, and just recently said he still supports him. Well, tell that to the Black folk in Chicago who want him out of office because he sat on this tape for a year knowing full well what the tape had to say. So when you start to get to a place where government is dysfunctional and you can't trust government, you can't trust the cops, that's not just a Black issue. That's an American catastrophe, as I said a moment ago.
Was a word you used earlier, or maybe I read it in the book, the issue of complacency. Are you just talking, when you talk about complacency, are you talking about African-Americans or are you talking about America as a whole when it comes to this?
I think all of us. Mm-hmm. I think before, with black folk, with regard to black folk and specifically, I said many times, and we say in the text, that before we can start talking about holding other folk accountable, government or anybody else, we must first hold ourselves responsible. And that means that we can't be complacent when it comes to being on the front line of fighting the fight that we need to fight, not just to redeem the soul of America, but to save black America for black children yet unborn. The problem is that we have crossed the line, I think, again, citizens across the board, not just black folks. I think we've crossed the line from, how might I put this, from skepticism to cynicism. Hmm. And I think it is that cynicism that allows someone like Donald Trump to rise in the polls. I've been on a terror lately on
you
this
have.
Book tour for the last few days.
Uh-huh.
And I've been on a terror because I'm not trying to pick a fight with Donald Trump. My point is that the media continues to cover this story as if Donald Trump is magically and mysteriously and wonderfully and surprisingly rising to the top of the polls. And none of that is true. Donald Trump is rising to the top of the polls because we and the media are covering him, but we're not challenging him. We're covering him, but we're not condemning him. So when you appeal to the worst in each of us, when you appeal to the dark side, the night side of America, when you are a racial and religious arsonist setting fires everywhere you go, that appeals to certain people. And if we're going to talk about Donald Trump rising in the polls, so we're covering the horse race, but not deconstruct the issues and what he is saying and why he's rising in the polls, shame on the media, shame on the American people. We're going to end up getting exactly what we deserve.
Just to let our listeners know, if they haven't heard already, you recently appeared on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos, and you referred to Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump as an unrepentant, irascible, religious and racial arsonist, like you just did right now. And later, Trump tweeted that you were a hater and a racist. So you're not as concerned about Donald Trump, then, as you are about the people that are putting him at the top of the polls.
That's precisely right. I'm concerned about what people are hearing when they hear Donald make these outrageous statements. I'm concerned about this white supremacist group who days ago started running a campaign, an ad campaign, supporting Donald Trump and saying in the ad why Donald Trump is the guy, why he's their guy, why we should vote for Trump. So you got a white supremacist group now running ads supporting Trump. Now, clearly, Donald Trump is not responsible for those who support him. I recall the debate years ago, and you may recall when Ronald Reagan received that support, that check from the log cabin Republicans, the gay mm-hmm. Republicans back in the day, and Reagan tried to distance himself from their support. So you're not responsible for those necessarily who support you, but you are responsible for not coming out and condemning, for not denouncing that kind of nonsense. So Trump was so busy tweeting about me that apparently he hadn't got around yet to denouncing these white supremacists. And the media hasn't checked him on that. This is my point, and we're letting him get away with this mm-hmm. to the detriment of the American people.
You're listening to Tavis Smiley. He's the host of the Tavis Smiley Show, and he compiled and edited a new edition of The Covenant with Black America. It's entitled The Covenant with Black America, 10 years later. If you have a question or comment for Tavis Smiley, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Where you live in many ways affects how you live. For African Americans, the story of resegregation and the shaping of inner ring suburbs, once symbols of successful middle class living, have been transformed by poverty and crime, and the story of that is all too familiar. Affordable housing and equal access to that housing remains an issue for the black community. Public media talk show host and activist Tavis Smiley covers the crucial issues facing African Americans in a new collection of essays on the topics. The book is entitled The Covenant with Black America, 10 Years Later. Still with us, Tavis Smiley. You, in his chapter entitled A Call to Action, Cornel West refers to the rich tradition of deep democracy in America. Talk about that and why it matters in this context.
Well, Black America, and at our best, we have called America to its conscience time and time again. At our best, it is that Black prophetic tradition that's challenged America to live up to the best of her ideals. And what we've seen over the last 10 years, in many ways, certainly over the last, almost 8 years of the Obama administration, is that Black prophetic tradition has been put on life support. Put another way, too many Black leaders have been deferential. Too many have been silenced and sidelined. And again, on a certain level, I get this. You don't want to, again, pile on or feel like you're piling on to the Black president, who's catching enough hell already. But the problem is that when you love Black people, you hate seeing them misrepresented. When you love Black people, you hate seeing them marginalized, exploited, treated as an afterthought. And so you have to make demands of any president, whether they're Black or white or male or female, Republican or Democrat. You have not because you ask not. You have to make those demands. And so our tradition in this country as Black folk, starting with our greatest hero, Dr. King, is to speak truth to power. And one of the reasons why these conditions have worsened over the last 10 years is that everybody's been so skittish and so scared about speaking truth to power because they don't want to offend the Black president. That's the problem.
So has it been better for Black America or worse that we finally have an African-American president?
Oh, as always, Ann, you ask the good questions. You ask the tough questions. I think the historians are going to have a field day, have a difficult time, put another way, trying to figure that out. Because they're going to have to juxtapose again how in the era of the first Black president, Black America tanked. The bottom fell out for Black America during his tenure. And so as we lay out in the book, clearly there have been pockets of progress. Mm-hmm. You don't go a 10-year span without having some progress. But again, on the major economic issues, we've lost ground in every single category. So it is at best a mixed bag. But back to our earlier conversation, time is running out. And so this book is about, pick your metaphor, ringing the alarm, beating the drum. But you got, by any means necessary, you got to get people to wake up to recognize that if we don't start to address these issues now, like in this presidential election campaign with Donald or Cruz or Hillary or Bernie, somebody has got to be held to account for what their agenda is going to be to turn around all of these issues that are confronting and conflicting Black America.
The book starts by addressing the topic of health, but I want to start with law enforcement and criminal justice system in the United States. And I'll do that with taking a call from Jim in Cleveland. Jim, you're on the air with Tavis Smiley. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ann. I appreciate it. What a great conversation today. I think for any Americans that grew up in the 60s, and of course, it was so heavily influenced by Martin Luther King and the nonviolence. And one thing I recognize today and is that it seems like we're the only developed country that has such problems with guns. And we could go on for that forever. But I have a sense that the police forces in most of our cities are being militarized. Everything you see on TV is like that. And mm-hmm. I was wondering, who are the new voices to speak to that? And is that essential? Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Jim raised a powerful point, Ann. Our police forces are being militarized. I did reference earlier there are some pockets of progress, and because we've seen so much over the last decade of these Black boys and Black men, and for that matter, women as well, being shot and killed by cops, and cops now, police departments, police chiefs, are starting to feel the pressure that's being brought to bear. They're starting to feel that level of distrust rising when it comes to the American people and those who are sworn to protect and serve. So the good news is that there are a number of police forces, Ann, who are starting to be a lot more progressive on these issues. We say in the book, it's not policing the community, it's community policing. And there are people who are starting to understand that distinction because they do get that they're starting to lose the trust of the American people, and a lot of that comes because these departments are being militarized. I go back to Dr. King, who Jim referenced in his call a moment ago,
uh-huh.
And King was really talking about three things near the end of his life, and as you know, those three things he called the triple threat facing our democracy. King's triple threat: racism, poverty, and militarism. Racism, poverty, and militarism. King was right 50 years ago. He's right today. Those three things are tearing America apart at its very fiber.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. If anyone else out there has a question or comment for Tavis Smiley, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You could email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We keep hearing, I guess I go back to technology and advances in science and so forth. So many people are maybe not enough, but many people are being freed from prison, having their sentences changed because of DNA, the advances in DNA technology and that kind of thing. And it's It's shocking people what we're discovering about how the criminal justice system has operated. I'm not going to use the word worked.
Yeah. No, I hear your point. And you're right. These stories come out. They don't come out as often as they should, but they do come out. And you're right. When they do come out, they shock us. And they shock us because it's hard for us to imagine ourselves being in that situation, being in that position. I'm always talking to young people about the distinction and the difference between sympathy and empathy. People don't need your sympathy. They do need your empathy. They want to, especially poor people and those who've been disenfranchised politically, socially, economically, or culturally, they need your empathy. You putting yourself in their shoes and understanding what it would be like to walk in their shoes. Social justice, then, is about wanting the same thing for everybody else's kids that you'd want for your kids. And so when you see somebody walk out of prison wrongfully accused, they've been there 20, 30 years, your empathy allows you to put yourself in their situation. You say, my Lord, how could that have happened? So there are other folk who are caught in the same situation. I will say again, back to these pockets of poverty, because this isn't just doom and gloom. One of the areas, Ann, where we can make some progress, and the signs are pointing at least in the right direction, is in criminal justice reform. It appears now that on the Hill in Washington, there is bipartisan support for making some significant changes to the way we do criminal justice. Now, having said that, sometimes we do the right thing for the wrong reasons. The reasons for wanting to do this is because we're spending too much money,
right?
Because the process isn't working, because we imprison more people in this country than any civilized nation in the world. So that sometimes we get to the right place, I think, through the wrong route. I'll take it any way I can get it. But criminal justice is one of those areas where there can be some bipartisan consensus and progress.
Beth in Columbus, you're on the air with Tavis Smiley. Hi, Beth.
Hi, Ann. Hi, Tavis.
Hi,
I'm
Beth.
I'm a huge fan of yours and Dr. Cornell West. The thing that really scares me the most is, like, I haven't seen things this agitated since, like, you know, when the crack epidemic came out. It was the end of Reagan's administration, and it was just so turbulent and disturbing. And, you know, as soon as a black president gets into office, everybody just goes and ups their guns. And it's overwhelming. And when I put postings on my Facebook page about things that I think that are wrong, you know, including the latest thing with Tamir Rice, I just, you know, people just don't want to deal with it. I mean, it's like white people can't be upset by these things. And what are we going to do? I mean, Trump scares the crap out of me. And I do agree with you about him not being held accountable to any kind of questions or follow-up questions. It's just like the reporters are just like halfway asleep on this.
Yeah. It's just, so, the point that Beth is making resonates with me, Ann, in part because that is exactly what Donald Trump is playing on. Not with Beth per se. She's very clear about her point of view. But there are a lot of people who feel that fear. And that fear that is so palpable in the country about our future, about a domestic terrorism attack. I just saw a survey the other day, Ann. We were discussing it last night on PBS, that says for the first time ever, a slight majority of Americans now feel that America's best days are behind it, not in front of it. when you have that kind of angst and that kind of anger and that kind of fear and fret, anything can happen in that situation. Somebody asked me, do you really think that Donald Trump can be president? I'm like, well, I don't want to believe that, but there are too many examples in history where somebody came along at the right, put another way, at the wrong time, and told the citizens that they were being attacked, and then they blamed the pacifists, and then they told them that we were on a dangerous precipice, and then they won. So anything could happen when you appeal to the dark side, the night side of America, but it's that fear that Beth is talking about that's got so many people looking for alternatives, and that's what's driving people to Donald Trump, and for different reasons, that's what's driving people to Bernie Sanders. They also are afraid that we're losing this democracy. Bernie has a very different prescription than Donald Trump does, but the people who support Bernie Sanders are afraid that their country is going to hell in a handbasket.
Sean in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Sean.
Oh, thank you. I tend to agree with a lot of what Tavis says, and I absolutely agree that, you know, as the black community goes, so goes America. And they're certainly the group that is the first off the plank when things go bad. But in the last 10 years, the whole middle class has just been completely screwed, for lack of a better term.
Mm-hmm.
For lack of
That's
more
right.
professional
yeah.
term. So mm-hmm. I wonder how, in your pointing out what to do to help the black community and what the black community needs to do to help itself, all that type of thing, how does that transfer to the greater population, so the community there?
Yeah. His name is John Anderson.
Sean,
thank you. Sean, thank you for your phone call. I appreciate it. Let me answer that question directly. This book that's out now is called The Covenant with Black America 10 Years Later. About a year and a half ago, though, almost 2 years ago, I wrote another book called The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. I give you again the title, The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. I wrote that book alongside Cornel West, who one of our earlier callers, Beth, I think, mentioned. In that book, Dr. West and I talk about how poverty, writ large, is threatening our very democracy, how poverty is now a matter of national security. In that book, we argue, to your point, Sean, that the new poor are the former middle class. That's your new poor. You got three groups that make up the poor, the perennially poor, the near poor, folk who are just a paycheck or two away from poverty, and the new poor. And the new poor, again, are the former middle class. So there's a whole book called The Rich and the Rest of Us that lays out policy prescriptions that we wrote to tackle this issue of poverty. And if we don't get that right, I go back to King with that triple threat: racism, poverty, and militarism. We're going to have to address this poverty issue. And these politicians are so politically correct. Everybody wants to appeal to the middle class. They don't want to use the word poor. They don't want to use the word poverty. But that's exactly what we have to deal with. And there's a highway these days into poverty, but barely a sidewalk out. So as I said earlier, these issues in many respects in the Covenant book 10 years later are black America's problem, but it's all of America's burden because poverty is threatening our entire democracy. When the environment, when we can't breathe the air and we can't drink the water, that is not a black problem. That's an American catastrophe. We don't trust the police. That ain't a black thing. That's an American problem. So all these problems eventually translate to the broader middle class and to all of America, and that's why this conversation in this presidential cycle, Anne, is so direly important.
Okay, Sean, thanks a lot for that call. 614-292-8513 is the number if you have a question or comment. Walter, let's turn back to the prison issue. Hi, Walter in Columbus. You're on the air.
Thank you so very much, Anne. I appreciate it. Tavis, it's my honor and pleasure to have an opportunity to speak your way.
Thank you, Walter.
Yes, I'm a 38th person to get out of prison with DNA testing in the first Franklin County to get out 19 years ago. And the main thing that I want to say, Tab, is we're never given a voice. And the community and nation could learn so much from hearing us tell our story. I was just talking to someone this morning, and I tell the story, and everyone is astounded and say things like, how can it happen? Mm. Well, if you let some of us have a platform, we can tell you how it happens. But we rarely get that platform, and that's the first thing. So I'm always available to try to shine light on how corrupt the system is. It's so easy to get in, it's so hard to get out. And finally, Tab, before you get off the air, can you give us 2 to 3 good solutions, simple possibly solutions, that we all as a society can implement to help better the black plight of America?
First of all, I want to say, Ann DeWalter, how delighted I am to know that he got out, and that he's been out for some time now, and he's using his voice to try to empower us with a story about how this does happen and how we can avoid it into the future. So my heart is my heart is heavy and happy at the same time to receive his phone call. In this book, we talk about the fact that we're going to have some meaningful criminal justice reform. And we also talk about the fact we're going to have some meaningful reform to reclaim our democracy. What Walter and so many others endure in this country when they get out, having paid their debt to society, and in his case, he was wrongfully accused.
Right.
But for those, I want to be clear, he's wrongfully accused. But for those who even committed crimes but have paid their debt to society, when they get out, so often they can't vote, and you have Republicans who are pushing an agenda for voter ID and against same-day voter registration. Anything they can do to make it more difficult to do is the legislation that they're behind. So we can't reclaim our democracy that way. And certainly we got to talk about, again, reforming our criminal justice system. But with regard to this question about three things we can do, one, I hope we'll get the text and read what the data is indicating to us about where we are, number one. First, you got to know where we are.
Okay.
Number two, the book lays out the missed opportunities. What opportunities were missed? And then thirdly, at the end of every chapter, there are solutions on that particular issue. There are policy prescriptions. There are things that it's literally broken down like this, as Ann knows. At the end of every chapter, it has a list that says, one, here's what every individual can do. Here's what the government can do. Here's what private sector can do. And here are examples. Here are short stories of organizations and individuals who are doing the work to advance the cause on this issue in the book. So you got 10 issues in the covenant, and on every one of them, we give you examples, we give you ideas, we give you solutions and examples of people who are actually doing this kind of work across the country. I think the book is as detailed a book as I've ever done, Ann.
Okay, and I think that was Walter Smith on the phone for folks if they want a reminder of who that was. Walter Smith, unjustly accused and served many years in prison and then released in recent years because of DNA technology. My guest is Tavis Smiley. He's the host of the Tavis Smiley Show and has recompiled and edited a new The Covenant book. It's called The Covenant with Black America 10 Years Later. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org as well. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Black Lives Matter movement has put the nation's racial divide front and center, but the issues that challenge people of color didn't crop up overnight. 10 years ago, writer and broadcaster Tavis Smiley and a group of fellow thinkers laid out evidence that blacks in America were disadvantaged in health care, education, job opportunity, and the criminal justice system. The group produced a New York Times bestselling book. A new edition has just come out. It's entitled The Covenant with Black America, 10 years later. Still with us by phone is the host of the Tavis Smiley Show and the editor of The Covenant with Black America, 10 years later, Tavis Smiley. Thanks again, Tavis, for joining us.
Thank you, Ann. My pleasure.
Let's get to the issue of health, because without health, we have nothing.
That is true. I think that the thing to celebrate about these last 10 years is the passage of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, if you prefer. And I'm the first to tell you that it is not what President Obama promised when he campaigned for the White House.
Mm-hmm.
It's way watered down. And, you know, I'm so thankful for Nancy Pelosi, the former House Speaker, now Minority Leader, because at one point when the president was about to throw his arms up, this story's been widely reported, It took Nancy Pelosi going to the White House and putting her finger basically in Rahm Emanuel's face as he was passing and saying to Rahm and to the president, we are not going to throw the towel at you. She had worked so hard to get her members lined up to get that signature legislation passed. But the president says it's his signature legislation. It is, but it wouldn't have happened if Nancy Pelosi hadn't told them we're not going to throw in the towel on this. And so that is something to celebrate in the months and years to come. As I said earlier, though, the problem is there's so many of those provisions, including that, you know, pre-existing condition provision, so much of that stuff hasn't kicked in yet. And so where black health is concerned, the gaps are still there. The disparities are still there. So, again, I think years from now, historians will give the president great credit for getting this passed. And I hope that in the years to come, we can improve upon that legislation. But there's still a lot of work to be done.
Right. Damon Tweedy, psychiatrist, he's also the author of a new book, relatively new book. It's entitled Black Man in a White Coat, A Doctor's Reflections on Race and Medicine. I interviewed him, a couple months ago or so, and he brought a lot of insights to the table as well, things that surprised him about people's behaviors and how to change how we think about our health and our bodies. And there's a big cultural divide on that score as well.
There's a big divide on that score, and just the issue, as I'm sure you discussed with him, this notion of culturally competent care.
Mm-hmm.
We live now in the most multicultural, multiracial, multiethnic America ever, and until the group of physicians who treat us in this country start to look more like America, there's an issue here with cultural competency in caring for patients. And so sometimes, stuff is lost in translation. Sometimes doctors don't know how to talk to patients who happen to be patients of color. Sometimes patients of color are not given the best options. As you said earlier, Ann, in this conversation, where you live determines so many things, including the kind of treatment you get or don't get.
Mm-hmm.
So this healthcare industry is fraught with all kinds of disparities and challenges. And again, none of this stuff is going to get fixed overnight. But it's important to understand that these disparities do exist, and we have to acknowledge them and figure out a way to get beyond them. I mean, for that matter, I was discussing this on my PBS show last night with Robert Kennedy Jr. and Dr. Keith Wailu of Princeton. We're discussing The Covenant, by the way, all five nights on my PBS program this week. We'll be digging into this book with the experts who helped put this information together and so get a deeper look every night on our PBS show. This night, Robert Kennedy reminded us that...
Tavis, you're breaking up.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yep, that's better. Yep.
My apologies.
That's okay.
Robert Kennedy reminded us last night that Tuskegee study, Ann, lasted for 40 years.
Right.
And he gave other examples of what has happened in 91 and 2004. The point is that so many black people still distrust the medical profession. That's the big hurdle we have to get over as well.
Yeah, then there's the reverse problem that Damon Tweedy experienced when he found that people didn't trust him either because they thought he must not be as good or they wouldn't be getting the black doctor.
Yeah, there's always that adage that you may have heard before, an old adage in the black community that the white man's ice is always colder.
Hmm.
There are folk who believe that the white man's ice is colder. That's just a fancy way of saying that if it's white, it must be better. There are a lot of folk who believe that, and sadly, because of white supremacist thinking ingrained in many black folk for centuries, for years, there are people who are black who believe that as well. So it's a sad reality, and oftentimes black professionals come up against that because they find with their black customers and patients that they don't get the respect they deserve because they don't think they are as white doctor or the other white professional.
Tavis, in reading the book, it's hard not to get overwhelmed by the breadth and depth of the problems. I mean, these 10 issues they're the basic fundamental, building blocks of a decent life.
Yeah. It can be overwhelming, except when you consider a few things. Number one, that black folk have survived slavery and segregation and Jim Crow and Jane Crow. So we're encountering right now. It's not getting better for us at the moment, but we've seen worse, number one. Number two, every poll, every survey, every study you can find, and some people find this counterintuitive unless you really know black people and know our tradition. with all the hell that black people are facing, would you care to guess, Ann, what the polls and surveys tell us about which group of Americans is still most optimistic about their future?
Well, I guess you're going to probably tell me African Americans.
Absolutely. Black folks are still hopeful and still optimistic. The line in the great black anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing, there's a line that says that we had a hope when hope unborn had died. When hope got to black folk, hope was already stillborn. It had died, and black folk have still found a way all these years later to hope. That's what Walter is talking about. Walter, you know, kept his faith. He kept his hope alive. And all these years later, you know, he, being wrongfully accused, is out now to tell his story. But you have to have an abiding faith in yourself, even when you can't see how the situation is going to turn out. So, yes, it can be overwhelming, except you consider that black folk have seen worse, number one. And number two, we are the most hopeful people. Now, having said that, we got to get to work. We got to hold ourselves responsible before we hold other people accountable. But don't ever tell black folk what they can't do. Mm-hmm. We've covered way too much ground.
Hmm. Dale in Pataskala, you're on the air with Tavis Smiley. Hi, Dale.
Good morning. Good morning, Tavis.
Good morning.
Dr. Trakas here in Columbus has focused a laser beam on the elections and people being pushed off the rolls and et cetera. We've had a problem here before, and there's great fear in 2016 that this electronic voting, which originally had its origins in Christian right-wing funding and coding as well. So I don't know if you can speak on that. And then also there's the Ohio Bureau of Workers' Compensation has $25 billion, that's B with billion, $25 billion invested in Wall Street. They pay out about $1.4 billion in claims a year, and of course they have their whitewashed, you know, fraud department that goes around and finds fraud. You know, they shove that in everybody's face like it's some big accomplishment or something. But it's a matter of poverty, which is obvious that the system, the money, it's just like people that don't have food, they're starving. People that don't have health care, they're sick. People that don't have water, they're thirsty. And it's the same thing with the money system. In Ohio, there's, I believe, vast discrimination in terms of where the money's being spent for the people,
yeah,
and not for the people,
okay,
kind of thing. But the election issue is
yeah.
I'm sitting on pins and needles waiting until,
okay,
you know. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Dale.
Thanks for your phone call, Bill. Yeah, we raised the name earlier in this conversation, Anne, of Dr. King. I come back to King now because King said something years ago, but I always come back to it and I talk to people like Bill who are raising these issues about government spending and what our priorities are. Dr. King said many years ago that budgets are moral documents. Budgets are moral documents. Budgets are not just financial transactions, they're moral documents. You can say who you can say what you say, but you are who you are. And we see who you are when you put your budget on the table. And so as I've gotten older and I guess a bit more mature, I take a hard look at budgets that politicians, elected officials, put on the table. Because once you look at any governor's budget, be it Kasich or anybody else, once you look at their budget, you see what their priorities are. Because budgets are, in fact, moral documents. So whether you're talking about elected officials, whether you're talking about investment groups, whether you're talking about other public interests, when you look at how they're investing and how they're spending their money, it says something about their priorities. And so in this election cycle, that's exactly what we have to focus on by asking the tough questions about what are your budget priorities?
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that budgets are moral documents? What does it say about what you believe and who you care for when we look at your budget? So that's just something to keep in mind, that budgets, again, are moral documents.
Race gaps and wealth are already wide, and Dale kind of brought that up a little bit, but how much does wealth in and of itself determine the success of African Americans going forward?
Well, the two answers, it does and it doesn't. It does, or it would, if there were some black wealth. Clearly, you know, generational wealth passed down makes a difference. There are any number of names that your listeners could run off right now of families who we know, who we have known for decades and for generations, because the money keeps getting passed down.
Mm-hmm.
There is no black wealth to pass on to the next generation, because over the last 10 years, as you read in the text, the covenant 10 years later, over the last 10 years, black wealth has evaporated. Let me make it even more stark for you. More black wealth has been lost over the last 10 years than at any point in American history. Black folk have been wiped out vis-a-vis their wealth over the last 10 years. When I keep saying to you that over the last 10 years, we have lost ground in every major economic category, that's just not a one-liner. You unpack that, you come across issues like black wealth. And so it's a huge determinant. And it could be used for good if there was some wealth to pass on. But this Great Recession wiped out everything that black people had. It's going to take some time to rebuild it.
How does family structure fit in? According to the Pew Research Center, black children are much more likely to be living in a single-parent household. 54% of black children are in this type of household. Talk about the family structure. Does it matter or not so much?
It definitely matters. There's no doubt about that. I was blessed to be raised in a big family. I'm one of 10 kids, but my mother and father were there, so I'm the beneficiary of having been raised in a home with a mother and a father. And clearly, single parents can do the work. They can do the job. Easier, I think, if there are two people there doing it. But the nuclear family in this country is not what it once was. But it's also important to understand that while there's certainly, and we have to acknowledge this, too many black folk having babies out of wedlock, we are living in a single-parent culture. This is not just a black reality. It's an American reality that there are more single-parent families. I said to somebody the other day, here's the problem in a nutshell, Ann. Black folk don't get married, and white folk can't stay married. There's your bottom line. The reason why the divorce rates are so high is that white folk can't stay married, and black folk don't get married.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we are living more than ever in a single-parent society. So if that concerns you, it ought to concern you across the board. One of the issues I've had with President Obama is that he has, over the course of his presidency, and you know this has been written about many times, he tends to take these various opportunities to lecture black people. And black people don't need to be lectured. They need your empathy. You put yourself in their shoes, understand that the shoes they're trying to walk in every day. But he'll lecture black folk in a heartbeat, but say nothing to lecture other communities. And so when you talk about single-parent families, that is not just a black reality. It's an American reality. And if we care about putting families back together, there's a lot that can be done. But absolutely, to your question, it does matter, no doubt about it.
You know, speaking of lecturing black people, I can't help but think of someone like Bill Cosby right now.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I know that ultimately, you build trust one person at a time. What does it do to the community when someone like him gets crossed off the calendar of great African Americans list?
Yeah. Well, let me answer it this way.
Uh-huh.
Bill Cosby is one African American.
Right.
He's one American citizen. And I always caution, and I know this is not the purpose of your question, but I always caution against using any one particular person.
Absolutely, I agree.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I literally was on television this morning in a debate with somebody, and I said, if I took the unrepentant Dylann Roof, who walked into that church in Charleston, South Carolina, that one white guy, and killed all those black people,
mm-hmm.
if I took that one guy and used him to paint a broad brush of all white males, I said to a white male this morning on TV, you wouldn't like that. So I don't want to take the worst of our community and build a conversation around it. Here's what I believe: that every race of people ought to be judged by the best they've been able to produce, not by the worst.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to Bill Cosby per se, Bill Cosby has to answer to those women. He has to answer to his wife, and ultimately he would have to answer to his creator, his God, for how and what happened in the dark.
Tavis Smiley, we are out of time. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
Thanks, Ann. Appreciate it.
Tavis Smiley, host of The Tavis Smiley Show and author of The Covenant with Black America. 10 years later, actually, I should say the editor. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Shia Lanat, interns Summer Cartwright, Khalid Moalim, and Sydney Schaefer, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks again. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.